Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Transfigured. I am here again with Hank, and we are continuing our series on the Church Fathers. Today, we are talking about Eusebius of Caesarea, who I think is he's just a very interesting figure. He is most famous as a historian, but he's not a historian who just sat by on the sidelines and watched history go by. He was a very important figure in Christian history himself. And also, I've said this on the previous couple podcasts, if you're wondering, hey, Sam, you didn't make any episodes for a while. What was with that? Well, my wife and I had our third daughter, and so that meant that I couldn't have any episodes for a while, but I'm back. Hank and I are going to keep going. And for our next Church Fathers episode, are we going to do Constantine or Arius? Which one do you think?
Let's do Arius. Well, yeah, let's do Arius.
We'll do Arius. All right. Well, I'm sure we won't get anyone angry with that episode. So we'll do Arius himself next episode, which makes sense. Eusebius of Caesarea and Arius were very closely connected.
I assume Jacob will like Arius.
Jacob, you know, Arius is a Neoplatonist, really, is kind of the argument that I'll be making, and that he was probably too Neoplatonist for his own good. And so maybe Jacob might like Arius more than he anticipates. All right, so if you want to get excited for the next episode, we will talk about the arch-heretic himself, Arius, and from there we'll probably move on to Constantine. And then probably from there, we'll maybe even do a special episode on the Council of Nicaea. And then from there, probably Athanasius, I would suspect. But we'll be treading, by doing Eusebius and Arius and Constantine and the Council of Nicaea and Athanasius, we'll be treading over the same ground multiple times because all of these people live overlapping lives. But this is such interesting and important Christian history that I think it's worth going over a couple times from a couple different people's angles to really kind of sort it all out. But since we're going over this ground for the first time with Eusebius, we'll probably have to lay down some of the groundwork and timelines and definitions that will help get us through the other people as well. All right, so Hank, what can you tell us about Eusebius of Caesarea?
Well, Eusebius was born around AD 260, 265, they're not sure. He expired on May of 339. During where he was born and raised was where Origen left his great library. Eusebius became a disciple of Pamphilius, who took over from Origen. And so, one could say that Eusebius was probably, like Origen, the man of his time in the sense of knowledge of the church, of theology, of the whole structure. And what you have with Eusebius is he also lived under the Diocletian persecution. So that's going to inform a lot of what he has to say when Constantine becomes the emperor and Christian emperor of the Roman Empire. Eusebius wrote a lot. He was, like Origen, sort of a peacemaker, which, like Origen, I think looks like, because of some of the people he made peace with, the Orthodox and Catholic Church didn't want to make him a saint.
Yeah.
So, and finally, as we talk about Eusebius and the Arian heresy, we also talk about that no one loved Constantine as much as Eusebius loved Constantine.
Yes. Find yourself someone in your life who loves you the way Eusebius loved Constantine. That would be my personal life advice for anyone listening to this episode. Eusebius was from Caesarea. Caesarea is it's a port city in what we would call modern day Israel. It's sort of between Tel Aviv and Haifa. It was after Jerusalem was destroyed. It was sort of the most prominent city in what we would call Israel. And so it was, if you can remember, so Eusebius is very similar to Origen. So we won't spend a whole ton of time talking about maybe Eusebius's own personal theology, because for the most part, you could just say, see Origen for Eusebius's theology. And we did 4 episodes on Origen, if you're curious. And I had a conversation, I was monologued about Origen by Father John Baer, if you're curious. So if you want to understand Eusebius's theology, for the most part, just compare it to Origen. And the reason why it's so similar to Origen is Origen had grown up in Alexandria, but then he got into some disagreements with his bishop because Origen was sort of a popular preacher. And so he left Alexandria and moved to Caesarea, and he had been given a fair amount of money by some patrons. And so he had built himself a very impressive library, probably the biggest Christian library at that time. And then when Origen died, he kind of passed on to Pamphilius, who sort of took over the library. And Eusebius was born about 5 or 10 years after Origen died. And Eusebius was tutored by Pamphilius, who had been left Origen's library. And Origen, growing up in that town where that library was very intimately familiar with it. And then he took it over after Pamphilius. And then he was appointed the bishop of Caesarea in the year 313, which is interestingly the same year that Constantine issued his Edict of Milan, which it didn't. Some people think the Edict of Milan made Christianity the state religion, but that's not exactly correct. It brought an end to the persecution and ordered the return of money and property to the Christian church that had been taken from them. So basically it made Christianity a state religion, but not the state religion. The making Christianity the state religion at the expense of paganism and everything else will come much later. So it's the end of Christian persecution brought about by the Emperor Constantine. So Eusebius probably had access to more books, to more Christian documents, and also a lot of pagan documents. In addition to a lot of Christian learning, Eusebius was very well read, especially in Platonist philosophers. He, in fact, there are multiple Platonist philosophers that are pagan whose works have been completely lost, except for quotations that we have in Eusebius's works. So Eusebius actually liked to quote Platonist philosophers quite a bit in support for some of his doctrines. So he was a very learned man, very familiar with pagan philosophy and Christian history, and also pagan history. And so, but in addition to being very well read and publishing lots of books, he was also probably one of the most important, most well-known and most renowned church bishops in his time. He was probably, kind of through charisma more so than actual political power, one of the most important leaders of the Christian church. And he was at the Council of Nicaea. He kind of semi-presided over the Council of Nicaea. He gave the introductory speech and the end speech and was, you know, very intimately involved in the proceedings of the Council of Nicaea. We'll come to that again in more detail. But probably his most, important aspect was that he was very good friends with Emperor Constantine. And he wrote many of the biggest works that we still have about Constantine. He wrote a biography of him and many other works about him. And Constantine, it wouldn't be hard to imagine why Constantine liked him, because Eusebius said so many nice things about him that he was almost like, maybe this is too hard of a word, but he was almost like Constantine's propagandist in terms of promoting Constantine to the Christians of the empire and promoting Constantine to the pagans of the empire along with his Christianity. And so that was one of Eusebius's main roles. But the way that Eusebius is mostly remembered today is as a historian. That's kind of his main lasting contribution that we think of him as. He wrote a couple books of history. Hank, do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
His history is basically an orderly succession from the apostles to the present day that he writes. And that was seen as being having fidelity to the apostles' teaching. I think we've talked about this before, mainly with Irenaeus and Polycarp. But the early church fathers, and even today in the Catholic Church and in the Orthodox Church, the idea when they lay hands on the priest, they say, the bishop's laying hands on the priest saying that we could go all the way back to Peter. Right. So the idea is, he's writing a history that is attempting to be as completely true to the apostolic tradition. And that's, by the way, the big fights in the church is when the heresies come in, you're not being true to the apostolic tradition.
Right.
So he writes a history, and he spends a ton of time on, not surprisingly enough, Origen. A lot of his history is spent on Origen.
Right.
Yes, spends history on the apostles in the early churchmen, Irenaeus specifically. He's also harsh, unfortunately, Sam, on a biblical Unitarian named Paul of Samosata.
Yeah, he's pretty harsh. And I should say that for many of our episodes that Hank and I have already done, when we're talking about Church Father XYZ, we always basically read at least what Eusebius said about them as part of what we know about them, because oftentimes the biggest source of information, whether we're talking about Irenaeus or Paul of Samosata or whoever, oftentimes the most detailed historical information that we have about them is from Eusebius. So Eusebius has been lurking in the background of the podcast the whole time because he's one of our biggest sources of historical information on the early church.
Right. And unfortunately, for those of us who love ancient history, a lot of what the early church fathers wrote or what was written about them is lost to us.
Yeah.
And so Eusebius's church history is not lost. And so what's interesting, I guess, about Eusebius's take, at least on Paul of Samosata, is how he is a lot more convivial to Arius than he is to Paul of Samosata.
I mean, we'll get to this in more detail, but Eusebius is basically an Arian. This is, I think, something that most people don't know, because most people are like, oh, I've heard of Eusebius. He's probably either a saint or at least Orthodox. But Eusebius was a strong defender of Arius, and even later in his life, an opponent of Athanasius. And so probably the reason why Eusebius isn't considered a saint is because of his connections with Arius and his support of Arius in the Arian controversy. So we'll talk about that in more detail, and we'll explain exactly what Arian theology is. I think there's a grave misunderstanding what Arian theology is, but to spend a little bit more time on Eusebius the historian, in addition to church history, he also wrote a book called The Chronicle, which was a history of the world from Abraham to the present. What's interesting is that Eusebius did not start his history with the beginning of creation, which is the way that many of the Christian or Jewish historians had started their histories before him. But he started with Abraham because he thought that the biblical record prior to Abraham was probably best understood allegorically and not historically. Which, you know, that would not be hard for him to have that opinion, because that would be very influenced by Origen, who preferred to take those early stories allegorically. But
just to stop there for a second, right? When I believe Christians get in a lot of trouble when they look at the first few chapters of Genesis, I'm going to probably pester a few people here, is historical rather than allegorical.
Well, I look forward to our podcast trip to the Ark Museum in Kentucky sometime. Maybe you and I should.
Well, don't kick me out. Don't throw me out.
Okay. No, they'll throw me out first if I tell them what I actually believe.
Well, I don't know. they might throw both of us out at the same time. So we could have a very interesting podcast. The good thing is while we're down in that part of Kentucky, there's a lot of bourbon mills down there.
Yeah, so we'll go to the Ark Museum first. We'll get kicked out, and then we'll spend the rest of the day sipping bourbon at a distillery. How about that?
Buffalo Trace, Frankfort, Kentucky. Very, very good.
Sounds delicious to me. All right, so I was talking about the Chronicle. So you are right that it was not uncommon, and perhaps it was even the majority opinion among Christian scholars to not treat the early chapters of Genesis literally, as we would say it, or concretely, maybe is a better word, but to treat it as an allegory for deeper truths. So that was not something that Christians did only after the theory of evolution or something like that. That's an ancient tradition. But anyway, so Eusebius makes this chronicle. And if anyone's ever seen, have you ever seen a timeline where you can see here's what's happening in the Egyptian Empire, here's what's happening in the Roman Empire, here's what's happening in Persia, here's what's happening in different parts of the world, kind of at the same time, synchronized on a single timeline? Eusebius is the first person that we know of who ever made something like that. So he was a genuinely creative and inventive historian who was quite ingenious, who synced up the timelines of Egyptian history, Greek history, biblical history, Persian history, and Babylonian history, and maybe a couple others that I'm forgetting, and figured out how their timelines all fit together. Okay, when was the Trojan War in comparison to the dynasties of Egypt in comparison to the events of the Old Testament, right? There had never been anyone who had really worked that out before. And while he made a lot of mistakes by modern standards, and a lot of people can criticize some of his conclusions, you have to remember the materials that he was working with. And actually, for the most part, at the 10,000 foot view, he actually did a really good job. He used the Egyptian dynasties to, the timelines from Egypt to figure that out. He used the Olympiads because the Greeks had how often did they have the Olympics? Did they have the Olympics every 4 years or did they have some other interval? Anyway, he lined up Greek history with the Olympics, right, which happened in regular succession. And then he was able to compare that with biblical history and Persian stuff like that. And part of the point of this is that he could argue that the Judeo-Christian tradition was older than the Greek tradition, right? Moses was before Plato. Moses was before the Trojan War, right? And that the Judeo-Christian tradition was more venerable and more honorable because it was more ancient than these other traditions, which is why, we should respect it more than these others. And he dated Abraham to 2000 BC or something like that. And Moses to maybe 12 or 1300 BC, which is actually pretty similar to how most people would date it today, and a bunch of other things. So, and this work was actually copied and maintained by Christians throughout the Middle Ages and stuff like that. And it was considered the authoritative source on ancient history throughout the Christian world and really until maybe the Renaissance or something like that. So it was an incredibly important document that gave a really big high-level view of human history in multiple parts of the world. And Eusebius was even aware of Buddha and stuff in India. And he knew way more about history from a high-level view than we might think was possible for someone back then. And he was very influential on the, I would say, maybe the practices of history ever after him. So he really was a great historian. And we would call him, by any modern standards, a scholar of the first rank, given the materials that were available to him. Was he biased sometimes? Yes. Did he have strong opinions that probably colored his interpretation of history? Yes. He was a little bit notorious for being mean to his enemies and nice to his friends in the way that he wrote and recorded and transmitted history. But in any case, he was still better than anyone else. So that is really something that really needs to be said about Eusebius, is that he really was a scholar of the highest rank in his day with regards to history. So we should probably then maybe transition to Eusebius and the Arian controversy. So Hank, you asked me to give sort of a definition of Arianism and how it's different than biblical Unitarianism, and also how it's
different. Hold on, I'm getting my pad and paper right now.
Yeah. All right, get ready for this. All right, I would say that Arianism and Orthodox Trinitarianism are basically the same thing, except with a few minor details. So Arians believe that there is one God, the Father, right, who is the source of all things and the creator of all things, who is uniquely exalted and divine. And Arianism also really tends to emphasize the transcendence of God the Father, right? He can't be seen. He can't even really be known by us mere mortals down here. But sort of before the creation, God the Father begets the Logos, which is also the same as the Son, the pre-incarnate Jesus, at the beginning of his work, right? In infinity past, God was just alone. But then at the beginning sort of time, he begets out the Logos. And then the Logos is sort of like the image of God and the way and sort of like rationality and reason of God. And then God the Father creates everything else through the Logos, right? And so in the Old Testament, right, when we hear about appearances of God, whether God is appearing to Moses on Mount Sinai or Jacob is wrestling with God or Abraham posts, you know, the angels at his house, and all of the appearances of God in the Old Testament are actually God the Son, the Logos for an Arian. And this is also true of the Trinitarians at the same time. And they agreed on this fact that the reason is that you couldn't see God the Father, right? God the Father was essentially invisible and incomprehensible to us. But God the Father makes himself comprehensible through his image, which is the Logos. So when you hear about God interacting with someone in the Old Testament, it's actually the Logos. It's actually the pre-incarnate Jesus. But the differences between Arianism and Orthodox Trinitarianism, and for the record, also Arius himself and Eusebius and many of the other Arians use the word Trinity perfectly often, right? Arius actually uses the word Trinity more frequently than Athanasius in the writings that we have from him. So if we were to go back in time and say, hey, Arius, you don't believe in the Trinity, he would be like, what the heck are you talking about? I believe in the Trinity, you know? So the difference was not that the Trinitarians understood themselves as Trinitarians and the Arians did not understand themselves as Trinitarians. That was not what was going on. It was that the Arians believed that the Father begat the Son at a point in time, whereas the Orthodox Trinitarians believed that the Son was eternally generated by the Father. And the Arians believed that God the Father was so unique that it was incorrect to say that the Son had the same divinity as the Father, because the Father was invisible, the Father was eternal, the Father was the source of all things, the Father was unbegotten, uncreated, unsourced, etc., whereas the Son was visible, the Son could appear at a certain point in time. So all of those differences meant that God the Father had like hyper divinity and the Son had like divinity of a second class, right? You could maybe say it that way.
Which actually goes back to St. Justin Martyr, who called Jesus the second God, right? So he gave a hierarchy and said, of course, God the Father is the first God, Jesus is the second God.
Right.
So
yeah, and Arianism is really, I mean, it's pretty similar to a lot of the church fathers that we already talked about, honestly. So right. I would say one thing that happens is that from you can see this in sort of Athenagoras and Tertullian, and you can see this all the way to like Novation, who we covered. So from like say 150 AD to about 300 AD, the common teaching was that God in eternity past had his logos inside his mind. And then at the beginning of time, he begets out the logos and it becomes the second God.
Right? So Arius explicated that in more detail would be a proper way of explaining Arian theology.
Right. And he maybe draws a couple harder conclusions than some people liked. Like Arius would say there was a time when the sun was not, right? And this sort of ruffled some people's feathers. And he would also say the sun was begotten from, it was like created, right? Because like when you read Justin Martyr will basically say the sun was begotten of the Father. He was caused by the Father. He was created by the Father. He was made by the Father, right? He was generated by the Father. And basically all of those words mean the same thing to him, right? Yeah. But then what comes to happen is there comes to be a distinction between the Arians and the Orthodox Trinitarians, where the Arians will say he was begotten and created, but the Orthodox Trinitarians will say he was begotten but not made, right? And the Orthodox Trinitarians will say that this begetting is in eternity past and can't be said to happen in time, and that the Orthodox Trinitarians will also really want to say that the Son has the same quality of divinity as the Father, and that there's nothing that you can say that is divine of the Father that isn't also divine of the Son. Whereas for the Arians, that doesn't make sense, because that seems to make the Son an equal God with the Father. And then you have two highest gods, whereas the Arians like to say that God the Father is uniquely God in a certain sense and protect monotheism by protecting the uniqueness of God the Father. But the differences like are really pretty small, because the Arians will also say, yes, the Father created the Son, but that doesn't make him a creature like all the other creatures, right? Because the Son, the Logos, created everything else. So he's a creature in a certain sense, but he's not a creature in another sense, right? So, and all of time was made through the Son. So in a certain sense, the Son was created in time, but in a certain sense, time was created through the Son.
So I have a question.
Yes.
How come you're not an Arian and you're a biblical Unitarian? Because one could argue that the Arius is contending with the first chapter of John, taking seriously the Logos and the Word. And it seems like biblical Unitarianism has an issue with John completely. Are you sort of doing what Martin Luther wanted to do with James and just get rid of the book of John? And probably the first John too would be one that you'd want to get rid of.
Well, so the difference between a biblical Unitarian and an Arian is that a biblical Unitarian, or someone like Paul of Samosata, doesn't think that the Son was begotten before the creation. We think that the Son was begotten of the Virgin Mary, and that the Son begins to exist in the Virgin Mary at the conception, right? Whereas an Arian, kind of like a Trinitarian, would say that actually, no, the Son was begotten way back before time. And an Arian, like a Trinitarian, would say that all the appearances of God in the Old Testament are actually the Son, whereas a biblical Unitarian or Paul Samosata would say it was actually God the Father appearing through angels, and it wasn't the pre-incarnate Jesus. So when it comes to the incarnation, right, like the Logos becomes flesh and dwells among us, Arians and Trinitarians are in perfect agreement, right? They never argue about the fact that the Logos came down from heaven, became incarnate in a man, and then ascended back to where it was before. That is actually something that they share in common, right? And you don't see them disputing that. Basically, the entirety of the dispute is, was the Son eternally begotten or begotten at a specific point in time? Does the Son have the same divinity of the Father or a slightly lesser grade of divinity? But even the Arians call Jesus God. They even call him my God, right? And, you know, all of those sorts of things. They're perfectly happy thinking of Jesus as God, but they think of him as the second God, right? Not the chief God. But they call him God and all of those sorts of things. So the Arians and the Orthodox Trinitarians would interpret the prologue of John very similarly. But the Arians would point out that, hey, Jesus says the Father is greater than I, right, in the Gospel of John. Or the Arians will point out that in the Gospel of John, Jesus says, and this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent, right? So, you know, Jesus himself says that God the Father is the only person who is true God, right? Whereas Jesus is God from God, but not true God, right? You notice how the Nicene Creed says true God from true God.
Begotten, right? Not made, consubstantial with the Father.
And all of those statements back to back are refuting Arianism. Right. Arianism would say that the Son was God from God, right? He has a divinity from the God, but right. he doesn't have true divinity, right? He's not true God from true God. And the Arians would say he was begotten and made, whereas the Orthodox Trinitarians would say he was begotten, not made, right?
By the way, where was biblical Unitarianism hiding out during this time?
In Persia.
Okay.
We'll get to that. But somehow
when Paul Samosata got knocked out as bishop, everybody headed east.
Yeah, well, at the Council of Nicaea, Paul of Samosata's lingering followers were declared heretical, and they were said to need to be rebaptized if they wanted to re-enter the church. And any baptisms done by Paul of Samosata's appointees were invalid. And so that was actually one of the declarations at the Council of Nicaea. But we're not done with biblical Unitarianism yet. There will be a famous bishop in the 350s AD. Photinus of Galatia, who is actually a biblical Unitarian after the Council of Nicaea and is actually presides over a church council in 350 AD. So the biblical Unitarianism actually outlasts the Council of Nicaea, surprisingly, which doesn't seem like it kind of should, but it does. But I have to say that biblical Unitarianism seems to disappear sometime around the 400s AD.
When does it come back to the United States? Is that what happens?
Well, it appears again in the glorious Protestant Reformation when all truth reemerges from the dark ages of slumber.
Just another reason why the Reformation was, never mind. It's depressing.
All right. So let's go through the Eusebius and the Arian controversy. And so I've explained sort of the theological questions at issue, right? Which honestly are way more minor, I think, than most people think. I think that most modern people, when they hear Arianism, they think, oh, they didn't believe in the Trinity and they didn't think Jesus was God. And they kind of assume Arianism is something kind of like me, right? Where, oh, Arians just think that Jesus is just like a normal dude or something like that, yeah. Right? But that's not what Arians thought at all. Arians thought that Jesus was the pre-incarnate Logos made flesh, right? They just had a slightly different way of connecting the dots. Go ahead.
I'm also going to contend that if we talk to most Christians who believe in the Trinity and we ask them to describe it, they would describe it like an Arian.
Yeah, they would either describe it like a modalist or describe it like an Arian, probably.
Right.
So there was actually a survey. The Legionnaire Ministries does a survey that asks a bunch of questions to Christians. And one of the questions was that Jesus was the first and most perfect creation of God, right? And something like 63% of Catholics said yes, or something like that. A majority of Catholics said yes, that the Son was the most perfect creature of God, which is the Arian doctrine.
Why am I not surprised? I mean, we've talked about this before. We could talk about it until ad infinitum.
Well,
the catechesis, the catechesis, but... the catechesis of the Western Church is abysmal.
Yeah.
Okay. I almost find that the Western Church majors in the minors. Okay. So am I not surprised that you would do a survey? You would probably do the same survey of Protestant believers and get the same answer.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, who is it? William Lane Craig is a modalist. Okay. Yeah. I mean,
well, did you see his debate with Dale Tuggy recently?
No.
You should watch that. Yeah, that was okay. Pretty good.
But I mean, here's the problem, right? I mean, William Lane Craig has a vision of the Trinity that's almost like the Transformers.
Yeah. And okay. So William Lane Craig explicitly denies that the Son was begotten of the Father prior to the incarnation, which if you had gone to the Council of Nicaea and said, no, I actually think
he gets tossed out. He's a heretic.
If I showed up at the Council of Nicaea, they'd be like, oh, you're one of those Paulo Samosata followers. We got to rebaptize you. We know what you think. We think you're wrong, but like, we understand you, right? Mm-hmm. We think you're wrong, but we know where you're coming from. If William Lane Craig showed up, they'd be like, who the heck are you? that's the most idiotic thing. At least I understand why Paulo Samosata thinks what he does. I have no idea why you think what you do.
Well, one of the reasons why we're doing the Church Fathers, I hope, is to have an archive for people to access, to understand the history of our church, but also of Christian theology. I will say right now, there's very few deep thinkers like this in the modern church. Maybe I would say Pope Benedict, Hans Urs von Balthasar would be two of them. Okay. There aren't many. Mm. And it's Barron could be one. There's times when he gets off the rails a little, as far as I'm concerned.
Barron's perhaps weakest subject is, I would say, the doctrine of the Trinity. He does good at talking about Thomistic metaphysics and those sorts of arguments for God. But for Bishop Barron, the main enemy is atheists, right? Not Arians. And so when it comes to him talking about the doctrine of the Trinity, he is, I would say he could use some sharp.
I am hoping that one day I can moderate a conversation between Sam and the bishop.
All right, make it happen. Make it happen.
That would be fun. But you know, you're right. We have three strains of doctrinal Trinitarian theology. We have Arianism, and we have biblical Unitarianism.
There was also Sabellianism or modalism at the time, which was another school of thought.
Well, we know, at least with, when I see modalism, right, I'm like, somebody's been watching too much Transformers, okay? Yeah. You cannot be fully God. And then when the three come together, be more fully God, okay? Right. There's just, it doesn't happen that way, okay? I could contend with an Arian. Okay. I would just say, honestly, you're for Christ to be fully God, he has to have been consubstantial with the Father, but I can understand how you get there from some of what Christ is saying. Okay. Mm-hmm. But the Father is greater than I am. Okay. That's someone contending with a statement in scripture that, one of these days, I'm sure a biblical Unitarian will look at John 8 again and say, before Abraham I am, which means he existed prior to being incarnate in the Virgin Mary. But that's just, that's me. We could have fun with that.
And the Arians would agree with you on the interpretation of that verse, right?
Yes.
So let's go through a timeline of the Arian controversy.
Okay.
With kind of focusing on Eusebius's possible roles too, right? All right, so in 313 AD, Constantine issues the Edict of Milan, right, which we already mentioned tolerates Christianity in the empire. In 314 AD, Arius is appointed a priest or a presbyter at one of the most prominent churches in Alexandria. It's the church that has Mark's, the person who wrote the Gospel of Mark's relics, right? So it's a very important church. In 318 AD, a public dispute erupts between the presbyter Arius and his bishop, Alexander. Alexander starts teaching that the Son is co-eternal with the Father and has the same divinity. Arius reacts to this and says, no, Bishop Alexander, you're wrong. There is a time when the Son is not, and they do not have the same divinity, right? And so there's a public dispute between the teachings of the bishop and the teachings of this guy named Arius. All right. In 318, Bishop Alexander gathers a local council and excommunicates and banishes Arius and anyone who would agree with him. But kind of to Bishop Alexander's surprise, a significant minority of the clergy agree with Arius, who had been a very popular priest. In 318, that same year, Arius contacts his allies throughout the empire trying to enlist support for his views. And one of the allies that he lists is Eusebius of Caesarea. In 320 AD, a council near Constantinople, Constantinople's still under construction, but it's like outside Constantinople, composed of Arius's allies, declares Arius Orthodox and commands Alexander readmit him to communion and restore him to his priesthood. In 321 AD, Arius travels a little bit further and goes to Caesarea. Here, Eusebius of Caesarea convenes an even larger council composed of a great number of bishops in the eastern part of the empire, and they declare Arius's orthodoxy and again demand that Alexander readmit him. All right, so let's see here. I've actually got a link to, let's see here, something that I want to read. So this is Eusebius of Caesarea writing a letter to Alexander, who's the bishop of Alexandria, who has excommunicated Arius. All right, Eusebius says, your letters have misrepresented them as though they were saying that since the Son came into being from nothing, he must therefore be like the rest of creation. But they have brought forth their own document, which they have written for you, in which they explain their faith, confessing it in these very words: the God of the law of the prophets and of the New Testament begat an only Son before time began, and through whom he made the ages, and all things, begetting him not in appearance, but in reality, causing to him to exist by his own will. He is unchanging and unchangeable, God's perfect creation, but not a creation in the same way like one of other of God's creations. All right, and Eusebius continues. So surely indeed their writings speak the truth, since these opinions are certainly held by you also, when they confess that the Son of God existed before time began, that God also made the ages through him, that he's unchanging, God's perfect creation, but not like God's other creatures. But your letter surely misrepresents them as saying that the Son is the same as the other created things. They are not saying this, but they clearly draw a distinction, saying that he is not like one of the created things. Take care then, lest immediately again a pretext be found for arresting them and keeping them from moving about as they wish. Again, you accuse them of saying, he who was begat, he who was not. I would be astonished if someone were to speak differently. For if there is only one who exists eternally, it is clear that everything which exists has come into being from him, and whatever indeed exists after him. If it were not he alone who exists eternally, but the Son also exists eternally, how indeed could one who exists beget another who already exists? It would have to follow that there would be actually two who exist eternally, right? So there you can start to see kind of the nuts and bolts of the beginning of the Arian controversy, right? It's not about the incarnation. It's not even about the Trinity, really. It's about the inner workings of the Trinity, right? You know, and you can also see that Eusebius is striking a peaceful tone. Right? He is saying, surely you have to agree with these things, you most noble, you know, bishop, right? I'm one bishop writing to another bishop. right? You surely, you know, you agree with these things too. You know, let them in. You know, it's they're not that wrong. I think that this is all a big misunderstanding, right? Is sort of Eusebius's point. And so then Eusebius returns to Alexandria in 322, and he has these letters from all of these bishops, many of the most important bishops in the empire, including Eusebius of Caesarea, all declaring him orthodox and commanding Alexander to readmit him to communion. When he arrives in Alexandria, Alexander denies his request, and sort of Arius kind of goes into hiding in the city of Alexandria, and there's street violence, right? There's sort of gangs of people who support Arius and gangs of people who support Alexander, and there's kind of fighting in the streets and maybe even violence and death as a result of some of these street battles. So this is sort of the background. In 325 AD, a council was convened to replace the Bishop of Antioch, who had just died. The anti-Arians were in the majority at this council in Antioch and drafted an anti-Arian statement of faith and required all present to accept it. Eusebius of Caesarea was there and he did not accept it, and they excommunicated Eusebius of Caesarea, which is a pretty gutsy thing to do. That's in early 325 AD. In May of 325 AD, the Emperor Constantine convenes the Council of Nicaea. The attendance of the Council of Nicaea is mostly from the eastern part of the empire. There are not very many people from the western part of the empire because it's a longer journey. Arius is at the Council of Nicaea. Eusebius is at the Council of Nicaea. Alexander of Alexandria is at the Council of Nicaea. So all of these disputing parties are there. Constantine chose Nicaea because Constantinople was still under construction, and he didn't want to have it somewhere where it was already Arian turf or already anti-Arian turf. He wanted a neutral location because Constantine's goal is to sort of solve this dispute and bring about unity going forward. That's Constantine's main goal, is unity, 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 right? So he convenes it in Nicaea, which is basically his vacation home. It would be like, I don't know, if J.B. Pritzker convened a council at his summer home on Lake Geneva, or something like that.
His winter home in Florida while we were being locked down, and his family wasn't.
If Donald Trump held the Council of Nicaea, it would be at Mar-a-Lago, right? That's basically what's going on. It's like it's at a vacation home. So at the Council of Nicaea, Eusebius of Caesarea, who only a few months ago had been excommunicated, is asked by Constantine to give the opening speech and basically preside over the council. So basically what Constantine is doing is he's throwing his weight of support behind Eusebius, right? He's saying like, hey, you guys can't excommunicate this guy. You can't do that. But the Council of Nicaea drafts a creed that is anti-Arian. And Arius and a couple of his most hardcore supporters are not able to sign the creed and are excommunicated at the Council of Nicaea. But Eusebius of Caesarea signs the creed of Nicaea, which is something that you might not expect him to do. But he gives an explanation. So Eusebius, after the council is over, writes a letter back to his church in Caesarea and says something like this: there was nothing to contradict in this statement of faith we put forward. In fact, our most pious emperor, before anyone else, testified that it was comprised of most orthodox statements. He even confessed that such were his own sentiments, and he advised all present to agree to it and to subscribe and agree with its articles, with the insertion of the single word of the same being, homoousios, right? So Arius had previously been on record saying that the Son and the Father are not homoousios, right? He had previously used this word. And so homoousios, right? Maybe we should spend more time on this word some other time, but I think I had previously said that, anyway. So homoousios, which is of the consubstantial with the Father, of the same substance of the Father. Homo means same. Ousios means stuff or substance or essence or something like that. So same substance, right, is kind of the most controversial word in the creed. And Eusebius reports that it was Constantine himself who suggested that this word be included in the creed, and that this word was too intolerable for Arius and some of his most hardcore followers to accept. And so Eusebius is kind of having to wiggle his way around of explaining, even though he agrees with Arius's theology, why he can still accept this word, right? And he's explaining this kind of to his congregation, kind of weaseling around this. So how does he do this? Eusebius continues, Constantine, gave his interpretation of this word, saying that the Son was not the same being as the Father, according to what we experience in our bodies, as if the Son had come to be by dividing up or breaking off from the Father, for his nature could not be subjected to any bodily experience, as it does not consist of matter. It exists in a spiritual realm and has no body. Therefore, such things must be thought of in a divine and unspeakable concept. Such were the theological remarks of our most wise and most pious emperor, but they were intent on adding the word homoousios and drew up the following statement, right? And then he reads out the Nicene Creed. I'll skip that because people know the Nicene Creed. All right. And this formula was being debated. We made sure to inquire in what sense they introduced homoousios. Though intense questioning and explaining, the meaning of the words were examined closely. They explained that the phrase of the same being, or homoousios, indicated that the Son is truly from the Father, but he is not part of him. We felt that we could agree to this word when it was used in this sense, to teach, as it did, that the Son was from the Father, however, not a part of his essence. On this account, we agreed to this sense ourselves without denying even the term homoousios, since maintaining peace was our goal, provided we did not depart from Orthodox understanding. So he basically reinterprets the word homoousios to basically be not homoousios. But, it just goes to show that no word is basically unambiguous and can't be reinterpreted by someone to mean what they want it to mean. So that is how...
As children, that is why Eusebius is not a saint. Okay.
So he interprets even the Nicene Creed in an Arian way. Right. Okay. Right. So Arius and some of his followers get excommunicated at the Council of Nicaea. Right. All right. In 327, Eusebius convenes a council in Antioch that expels that bishop that had been appointed at Antioch, a couple years prior, and he gets him expelled for being a Sabellian or a modalist. And then they appoint an Arian bishop of Antioch. Right. So Eusebius, after the Council of Nicaea,
payback, right?
And he's also nervous that the anti-Arians have a little bit of momentum from the Council of Nicaea. Right. And so even though he found a way to reinterpret the words and wiggle around, he's like, we have a problem, Arians. We need to band together and we need to make some strikes, right? So the first person they strike is that bishop in Antioch. And Constantine was at this council and approves of the expelling of this bishop. His name was Eustantius. And then in 328, Arius and his friends go to Nicomedia, which was the temporary capital at the time where Constantine was residing. And Arius recites a creed to Constantine that was slightly different than the creed of Nicaea. No homoousios. No true God from true God, right? No begotten, not made language. But he recites a creed that, honestly, if I were to read it, most people would be like, oh, that sounds Orthodox, right? But it specifically avoids a couple terms that Arius doesn't like. And then Constantine declares Arius Orthodox, right? The emperor himself declares Arius Orthodox and writes a letter commanding Bishop Alexander to readmit him to communion. Right. And so it's one thing for Bishop Alexander to get a letter from other bishops commanding him to readmit Arius, because at the end of the day, Alexander can say, I'm a bishop. I have control over my own see. You guys don't have any authority over me. It's an entirely different matter when you get a letter from the emperor saying, hey, you need to readmit Arius. He sounds Orthodox to me. Let's end this dispute. Everybody get along. This is over. So Alexander does not accept this request. And this is really what I would say is the beginning of the Arian controversy, mm-hmm. when there is actually, you know, real hardcore fighting. But I'll fast forward a little bit because we'll cover the other stuff later when we cover Athanasius. But in 336 AD, Eusebius convenes a council with Constantine present that excommunicates Athanasius for heresy and for impropriety as the bishop of Alexandria. So Eusebius gets his revenge. And part of the way that he gets his revenge is that he becomes so closely tied to the emperor that he can kind of nudge Constantine to get him to do what he wants. So Constantine dies in 337 AD, the year after Athanasius is excommunicated. And then 2 years later, Eusebius dies. So at the death of Constantine, and I should also say that Constantine on his deathbed was baptized by an Arian bishop, you know, not Eusebius of Caesarea, a guy named Eusebius of Nick of Media, right? Two Eusebiuses, different Eusebiuses, but Eusebius of Nick of Media was a hardline Arian. So Constantine is baptized by a hardline Arian. Arius is declared Orthodox. Athanasius is excommunicated. And so at the death of Constantine, you would think the Arians were on their way to victory and had control over the empire and control over Alexandria, control over Antioch, and control over Constantinople. But we'll have to continue that story later because that's where it ends with Eusebius, and this episode's about Eusebius.
Right now, Luke is spinning around in his home in Minnesota as he realizes the great god emperor Constantine was an Arian.
Yeah, basically. I mean, what Constantine's own personal theology was is hard to say, but at the Council of Nicaea, it looked like he was siding against the Arians, but kind of through political jockeying behind the scenes, by the end of Constantine's life, he was mostly in support of the Arians.
I'm going to be very sympathetic to Constantine. We're asking this guy to be a top great theologian. He's being pushed and pulled by top great theologians, okay? Whether it's Eusebius, whether it's Athanasius, and what we're talking about is one word, okay? You know, we have one phrase that the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, is the Filioque, right? You know, it's words are pesky things. So,
Speaking of words, here's another word that I want your interpretation of. What does Christian nationalism mean to you, Hank?
Well, it means you're a supporter of Donald Trump and you're execrable and need to be ridden out of polite society.
Right, and you enjoy watching John Wayne movies.
Especially, how dare you, you know, watch John Wayne movies? I mean, my goodness, the guy is he's beyond the pale.
So to give a little bit of context, could you explain who Kristen Cobes Dume is and what the sort of current dispute over Christian nationalism that's going on in American evangelicalism?
So you want me to explain Kristen Dume? Okay.
Yeah. Could you steel man her if you don't mind? Yeah.
I can't steel man her. There's no way to steel man her. Okay. Sorry. I could steel man others, but she is not.
Steel manable.
She's a pamphleteer. She writes pamphlets. She writes screeds. So Christian nationalism has a very long, long historical artifact. By the way, actually, from prior to Eusebius, we have Athenagoras telling the emperor at his time that Christians are the best citizens of his empire. Okay.
Well, even Peter in 1 Peter or 2 Peter commands everyone to give honor to the emperor.
Correct. So we have to look at history, and we have in Eusebius's lifetime a great persecution in 303. So the man's about 38 years old.
And Diocletian, so the we kind of mentioned with Paul of Samosata that the empire was falling apart, right? In the third century, there was sort of a crisis in the empire where they were losing power. There was civil war and infighting. The emperors were very weak, right? And that was part of the reason why Queen Zenobia was able to take over some territory. So a guy named Diocletian becomes sort of the emperor who starts to bring things back together. He starts to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And he is a very strong emperor. And one of his underlings is Constantine, right? That's how Constantine kind of rises to power, is on the coattails of Diocletian. Mm-hmm. And Diocletian's program is make the emperor pagan again, right? Part of the reason why Rome is failing is that we're on the bad side of the gods. And part of the reason we're on the bad side of the gods is these darn Christians not worshiping the gods properly, right? So we're going to get rid of Christianity once and for all. And so the worst persecution, probably of the largest scale with the largest number of Christian deaths, was unleashed by Diocletian in around the year 300-ish. I forget the exact date.
Right.
And it was one of the worst periods in the empire for Christians, and many Christians died. And so it looks like, man, things are terrible for the Christians. But then Diocletian dies. There's a civil war between his underlings. Constantine wins the civil war, more or less. And then Constantine becomes the sole emperor of the Roman Empire and issues the Edict of Milan, ending persecution, right? So we go from the worst persecution ever to immediately, now we have a Christian emperor, right? In the span of even less than a decade. So that whiplash was quite a thing. And Arius lived through that. Eusebius lived through that. All the people that we've been talking about lived through that experience.
Right. And so one would expect that Christian leaders and all Christians would be very, very grateful to Constantine. So according to Eusebius, he believed the emperor was God's representative on earth, and that the word of God expressed God's will and creation through the world. So the emperor expresses the will of God in the government of the civilized world. Okay. Yeah. Sort of render unto God what is God, render unto Caesar's what is Caesar. Okay.
I've got some quotes to read that kind of go through this. They're kind of long, but I feel like it's extremely important. This is from what's it called? The Oration in Praise of Constantine, right? So chapter 2, paragraph 1, the only begotten word of God reigns from ages which had no beginning to infinite in endless ages, the partner of his father's kingdom, and our emperor, ever beloved by him who derives the source of imperial authority from above and is strong in the power of his sacred title, has controlled the empire of the world for a long period of years. So just as the logos, as the sun, has reigned from ages past to ages in the future, not something that most people would expect an Arian to say, but remember, this is an Arian saying this.
Right.
So Constantine has ruled for a long period of time, and Constantine derives his imperial authority from above, and he has a sacred title, right?
Yep.
And so like this connection between the logos, the Son of God ruling from heaven, is mirrored by the emperor ruling from earth.
So, and for 1,000 years, 1,200 years actually, both the Eastern and the Western Church had this view of, we call it the Holy Roman Emperor, right? Charlemagne, being the most famous. A lot like Constantine, well-read, very philosophical. In the Eastern Church, right, you had the power of the Eastern Church was in Byzantine, was there, and the emperor there had great authority within the church. So
I would say one of the interesting things that's different between the East and the West, mm-hmm, is something like this. In the East, there were multiple important bishops, right? Bishop of Constantinople, Bishop of Alexandria, Bishop of Antioch, etc., right? And these bishops were all kind of equal, but what united them was the emperor, right? The emperor, there was one emperor and multiple important bishops, right? But in the West, the situation was kind of the opposite, right? There's the king of France, there are kings and princes in Germany and Italy and Spain and all this stuff. So there was political, you know, multipolarity, but what united all of these different politics was the one bishop, or right, the Pope, right? The Bishop of Rome. So in the West, you have one bishop over a bunch of different kings, but in the East, you have one king over a bunch of different bishops. Right. And that's sort of the main difference. And in the East, you get this hyper elevation and almost like quasi divinization of the emperor. And in the West, you get this hyper elevation of the bishop, of the Pope, and this quasi divinization of the Pope. Right. You know, the Pope is the vicar of Christ in the West. The bishop or the emperor is the vicar of Christ in the East. Right. And that's sort of the difference. And that difference plays out in many interesting ways over the course of 1,000 years.
However, both are facets of Christian nationalism.
Yeah.
Okay. Both are facets. So going back to try to steal man Christian Dumais, this stuff on Constantine Christian is very easy to find. It's not hard.
Okay. So you're saying that Christian nationalism predates John Wayne?
Predates John Wayne. As a matter of fact, I would contend that Christian nationalism is what ended slavery in the United States. It was Christian nationalism that ended slavery in Great Britain, okay? And then caused Great Britain to go throughout the world trying to end slavery at great cost to itself. Of course, as Christians, we want to be the best citizens of the state in which we live. So if I live in Kenya and I want the best for my Kenyan neighbors through the artifact of the church and the government, I would be a Kenyan Christian nationalist, or a South African Christian nationalist, or an Indonesian Christian nationalist. Of course, that's how it works. And that's how it's always worked. As a matter of fact, going back to Peter, Peter's very clear, but the apostles were very clear that we needed to honor the government in which we lived in, okay? So this idea that this Christian nationalism is really has come out in the last 8 years. No, but ever since Trump went down that escalator, okay? Because all these people are complaining about Christian nationalism. They had no problem with George Bush's Christian imperialism. Okay. So the idea is, you know, we look at Constantine, and I mean, Constantine, you know, Eusebius says in Constantine that we have a true friend, protector, and guardian who brought to the light the plots, devised in darkness and secrecy and frustrated them. So powerful is a great weapon of godliness for the repulse of the enemy and the preservation of its own. I mean, my goodness, nobody has written about that, about Donald Trump. Okay. Right.
Can I do another important quote that echoes the same point? It's from that same oration of Constantine, from Eusebius. And as he who is the common savior of mankind, by his invisible and divine power as the good shepherd, drives far away from his flock like savage beasts, those apostate spirits which once flew through the airy tracks above this earth and fastened on the souls of men, so this his friend, graced by his heavenly favor with victor over all foes, subdues and chastens the open adversaries of the truth in accordance with the usages of war. So in the same way that Jesus had scared away the demons from, you know, from the airy tracks above this earth, right? We've talked about this before, that in the ancient cosmology, the demons and Satan lived kind of in the air, right? The prince of the power of the air, right? That's what Paul calls Satan.
Principalities and powers, yeah.
Right, right. So there's these evil forces kind of in the air. In the same way that Jesus's victory had sort of scared away the demons, the victory of Constantine scares away the enemies of God through the usages of war. And this is a very interesting thing to say, because you and I both know, Hank, that all of the church fathers we've read so far were pacifists, right? All of them denied the use of violence. All of them denied serving in the military of the empire and stuff like that. But yet all of a sudden here Eusebius is saying is that the Emperor Constantine was accomplishing God's will and winning victories by his heavenly favor with warfare, right? And that's a very different theology than we've seen before.
Yes. And that's, we're going to have to, this is now sussed out for the next 1700 years in church history.
Yeah. And so I think that it's really hard. I mean, like, I want to do some favors to Eusebius, right? Like, okay, the empire is becoming Christian. Like, basically anyone would have to interpret that as an act of God, right? Every Christian at the time thought that God was doing this for on behalf of the Christians. And so there's going to be some changes in theology when you move from this persecuted sect to this empire-supported and even empire, you know, unique faith, right? And Eusebius is getting out ahead of this transition. He sees where the church needs to go to transition from this small persecuted sect to this universal religion of the universal empire, right? And so he's doing this, you know, Christological parallelization, where in the same way that Christ conquers the heavens, the Emperor Constantine conquers the earth. In the same way that there's one Lord of heaven, there's one Lord of earth. And that's Constantine. In the same way that there is a kingdom in the heavens, there is a kingdom on earth. And the kingdom of God is the Roman Empire ruled by the Christian Emperor Constantine, right? And that's pretty different from, you know, Jesus's message about the kingdom of God. But as in, you know, your will be done in heaven as it, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Who's doing God's will on earth as it's being done in heaven? Constantine is, right? And this is a level of Christian of fusion between the divinity of Christ in heaven and the quasi divinity of the emperor on earth. And I never heard anyone say anything nearly that exalted about Donald Trump.
No, and you know, if you listen to Jonathan Pageau on Constantine, Eusebius rings in Pageau's words. Mm-hmm. Okay. Constantine has a high status within the Orthodox Church.
He's literally a saint.
Right.
And he has feast days to him and multiple things of that nature.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot, I listen to a lot of modern day theologians, most notably John MacArthur, basically saying Christianity sort of ended when Constantine became a Christian. And all I would say to John MacArthur is, dude, why don't you get martyred or live like they lived for 300 years? And if somebody said, I'm a Christian who's in a position of power, we're going to stop persecuting Christians, we're going to give them back their property and their church, how many people would say, no, we don't want to do that. We still want to be against the government. No one. Mm-hmm. No one. They would see that was God's providence. And one could argue that the growth of Christianity exploded because of Constantine's relief of persecution of Christians. Again, you know, none of us in the West have ever been under the gun like Christians were under the gun for 300 years.
Right.
Okay. I have a far more sympathetic position on Eusebius, which is, one, Eusebius looked for trying to find peace wherever he could. Two is, Christians were looking at the expansion of the empire as an ability to expand Christianity. The idea that you're expanding in areas that are under the empire. We've seen this with Great Britain under the Wesleyan tradition of the first real Protestant church starting to do missions, right? They went and did missions where? In Africa, under British colonial rule. So there's a long history of this, and it really starts with Constantine.
And Eusebius is sort of the great articulator and the great orator and theologian,
right,
who articulates and brings about this transformation in the realm of the church and theology.
Which makes it odd to me that the Orthodox Church has not made him a saint.
And it's because of his associations with Arius, right?
Right.
That's why he cannot be. I have a couple more thoughts that I want to get out before we run out of time.
Okay.
So part of this transition from persecuted sect in the Roman Empire to state-supported religion of the emperor himself is eschatology. So we have read before in Irenaeus and Tertullian and Hippolytus and other people about premillennialism, right? The idea that there's going to be an antichrist figure, and they basically all thought the antichrist would be an evil Roman emperor, right? And he would lead an evil persecution, right? And then just as things looked like they couldn't get any worse, then Jesus would come back to earth, right? And establish a 1,000-year reign of the Messiah on earth from Jerusalem, right? And this was taken from Revelation and other passages in the Old Testament to be the understanding of eschatology. Well, this eschatology, and there's this very strong contrast between the evil kingdoms of this world, right? And then the good kingdom, which would only be established once Jesus returns, right? That politics is bad, and that the empire is going to be the source of the Antichrist. Well, this theology doesn't work very well if you are a state Christian religion, right? So Eusebius, one of Eusebius's main roles that we didn't talk about very much was assembling the canon. He talks a lot about which books of the Bible everyone thinks are should be in the canon and which books people disagree about and which books people don't think should be in the canon, right? He spends a lot of time in his church history on that subject. One of those books, the book of Revelation, Eusebius takes every chance he can to say not everyone agrees with it. Lots of people don't think it was written by John. Lots of people find it impossible to understand, and lots of people disagree with his theology. And Eusebius takes every chance he can to take pop shots at premillennialism for being literal-minded, to being too similar to Jewish theology, and to not understanding the true mystical interpretation of scripture. And he is really the first person to push what's called amillennialism, right? The idea that there isn't going to be a literal 1,000-year reign, but that these things need to be interpreted allegorically. And so he ends, basically, premillennialism as an acceptable view within the church because it's not compatible with this Christian empire. And instead, he basically interprets allegorically, and maybe even not even allegorically, the Christian empire as the millennial kingdom, right? Instead of us waiting for Jesus to come back to establish the kingdom on earth, the kingdom on earth is now, right? Constantine is the kingdom of God on earth. And there's this allegorical interpretation that allows that to be interpreted that way. And so you Catholics are still amillennial to this day, and it's because of Eusebius. And premillennialism doesn't reappear on the scene until the Protestant Reformation. And premillennialism is now very popular in the American church, right? You know, like if you read Tim LaHaye's Left Behind and stuff like that, right? That's premillennialism, right? There's going to be a tribulation and a rapture, and then Jesus is going to come back and there's going to be a 1,000-year reign, right? That's premillennialism come back. But it was incompatible with Eusebius's view of the empire, and that Eusebius tries really hard to cement this new amillennial, which is a more allegorical and loose interpretation of how the kingdom of God relates to the kingdom of earth. And I would say, you know, there are some passages that I didn't quite read that I'll just summarize, where he basically talks about the role of the emperor and the role of the church is basically to make pure souls as an offering to God so that their souls might go up to heaven and be in the, you know, kingdom of God in heaven, right? The basically the church is a is the goal is to send their soul to the right place and not to the wrong place, right? And that this is the offering essentially that the emperor offers to God in his worship, right? And when you worship, you offer a sacrifice. What's the sacrifice that the emperor offers? It's the refined and purified souls of his subjects. And so I would say in Eusebius's theology, there's really no role for the return of Christ, right? There, why does Christ need to come back and establish a kingdom? That's just millennialism. There's no real, he doesn't deny the return of Christ, but it plays no central role in his theology. And it's almost kind of pushed to the side and ignored. And there's also no role for the resurrection because the goal is to get souls up to the heavenly place, right? What's the point of a resurrection if your soul's already happy in heaven? Why tug it back down to a body? That doesn't make sense, right? So I would say that the idea that Christianity is a religion that's designed to get your soul to heaven when it dies instead of to hell, which I would say is kind of you Catholics still struggle with that, right? This is a result of the theological transformation that Eusebius initiates to help make the Christian religion compatible as the empirical religion of the Roman Empire.
And so Eusebius' thoughts there, right? So we could bifurcate two things and round up the conversation. One is the amillennialism, right? Mm-hmm. But the other, that souls are going to heaven. I would contend that Eusebius is in error with Gnosticism.
Yeah.
It's very clear that we're talking about resurrection of the bodies. The Bible is not unclear about that at all. Of course, Catholics believe in the resurrection of the body. Okay.
Ostensibly.
What? You know what? Settle down there, Paul of Samosata. Samosata. Okay. And I think I think Constantine's conversion to Christianity had a profound effect on Eusebius, who had been terrorized by prior Roman emperors, right?
And him and every other Christian alive.
Right. So, hold it. I don't have to wake up every morning wondering if I'm going to get martyred. Okay. I've got a guy that.
Hey, and priests don't need to pay taxes anymore. So, like,
it still happens around here, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that when we get to Constantine, that's going to be an interesting conversation because clearly the man has a very subtle mind. And I'm going to be very interested to read on him because he clearly understands some things politically. One, you know, Augustine brings this out. You're getting rid of all these gods that you have to worship. By the way, what we're seeing in the United States and the West now is worshiping a ton of gods, and we're seeing what that does, right?
Okay. It causes disunity, right? And Constantine's chief goal, number one goal, the empire had been divided. I brought it back together. So just as we have one emperor, we also have one God, and we have one form of worship.
He did it through peace, in a sense.
Yeah.
Rather than through martyrdom and war.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Constantine was pretty religiously tolerant. He didn't force Christianity with the sword. That'll come later. Constantine was actually relatively open-minded.
Oh, no, he even said in one of his edicts is, I am not going to force people to become Christians.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. This will be an interesting discussion, and obviously we'll refer back to Eusebius more as we're talking about Constantine. We can't help but not. Okay. Mm-hmm. You have the great emperor, and you have his great propagandist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like I said, when I started reading, I wish I was president of the United States and Eusebius was my press secretary.
Yeah, okay. That's right. Yeah, that's what Eusebius is. He's like the theological press secretary of Constantine.
But I'll take him because, you know what?
He's good.
I would go to bed every night thinking very highly of myself. Whether I should or shouldn't, I would think very highly of myself, okay? Yeah. I mean, like I said, this is a big transitory time in the Christian faith.
It's a big moment.
It's a moment that informs us for the next, till today. And we need to understand how it's like you throw a rock in a pond, we're going to see these ripples. We have to start explicating and unpacking what those ripples mean.
Yeah.
Well, Sam, excellent. This was, it's been, 2 months?
Yeah. So you can call me Sam of Samosata from now on.
Absolutely. You know,
all right.
But I dare not call you Arius.
Right. So speaking of Arius will be our episode for next time. Can't imagine we'll get in any trouble for that. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Hank.
Thanks, guys.